Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO Portland. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I'm going to be your host this morning for the Old Mole Variety Hour with views, reviews, and interviews from the ground up. If I had to pick a theme for today's show, it might be that we are living in times that are more perilous than any that humanity has faced since the great conflagrations of the first half of the 20th century. From deadly infectious disease to accelerating militarism that features nuclear annihilation, from climate catastrophe to a growing global apparatus of brutal repression. Those of us who envision a sustainable world of harmony and prosperity for all have a daunting task ahead of us. That's also part of what we take up this morning, including the imperative to recognize, protect, and restore Indigenous rights for the good of all humanity. We're going to start off this morning with the big lie. No, not that one. The lie that the U.S. is a force for peace and justice in the world. Laurie Mercier takes aim at the hypocrisy of U.S. defense against grievous Russian aggression while pursuing its own military interests around the world. Following that, Fran Michel reminds us that the pandemic is not over and throwing the medically vulnerable under the COVID bus is not good for the public's health. Then Bill Resnick talks with John Bellamy Foster about how the imperatives of the global economic system of capitalism have led to unprecedented environmental degradation that is rapidly becoming a threat to the very existence of humanity. Following Bill, Desiree Hellegers and Julian Ankeny preview an upcoming social justice conference featuring issues in Indian country, from reparations to food sovereignty, from missing and murdered Indigenous people to Black and Indigenous solidarity. We'll close our show on a hopeful note. Norm Diamond reads and comments on inspirations from Pentagon Papers thief Daniel Ellsberg. First up, Laurie Mercier takes on the hypocrisy of U.S. global interventions.
On the 20th anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq, which cost the United States upwards of $3 trillion, leaving Iraq with 1 million dead, another 7 million displaced, and in such dire straits that most Iraqis long for the days of Saddam Hussein, elite policymakers have learned that they can get away with endless spending on warfare. Katrina Vandenheuvel writes in The Nation that much of the commentary around the 20th anniversary has sought to justify or diminish the calamity, and none of the perpetrators, propagandists, and cheerleaders who drove us into the war suffered any consequences. In fact, those who led us into invading Iraq in 2003, with tens of thousands of more troops than Putin used to invade Ukraine, continue to dominate America's major media platforms. Although they launched an illegal war of aggression and committed war crimes in Iraq, 20 years later, the leaders of the U.S. have never faced criminal accountability. By contrast, the ICC has already charged Putin with war crimes just 1 year after his unlawful invasion of Ukraine. The United States has used the invasion of Ukraine to justify a proxy war to weaken Russia, expand NATO and rearm the continent, and advance Western capitalism in Eastern Europe. This escalating war is plunging people around the world into a future of uncertainty, poverty, and carnage. We're now facing the greatest risk of nuclear war in history. As Chris Hedges notes, Ukraine, like Afghanistan and Iraq, will bleed for a very long time, and this is by design. The American militarists who have waged permanent war have invested heavily in controlling the public narrative. The enemy, whether Saddam Hussein or Vladimir Putin, is always the epitome of evil, the new Hitler. Any inconvenient truths, such as the U.S. provoking the war or the realities of an Eastern Ukraine that identifies with or speaks Russian, are ignored. Anyone who questions the righteousness of the cause is dismissed. The White House, Congress, and the media have as their goal to keep billions of dollars flowing into the hands of the war industry and prevent the public from asking inconvenient questions. Racism is at the core of reactions to what Noam Chomsky calls the worthy victims. Although we see signs around Portland that proclaim, "We are all Ukrainians," we have not seen similar expressions for Iraqis, Yemenis, and Palestinians, all of whom have suffered violence inflicted by U.S.-supported wars that we actually have control over. U.S. immigration policies have favored white Ukrainian refugees while slamming the door shut on Haitians and Salvadorans who are fleeing the violence caused by U.S. interventions in the Caribbean and Central America. Historian Vijay Prashad deconstructs the global North's hypocrisy, noting that wars in Africa and Asia are rarely commented upon with any feeling in media outlets across the world. For example, the war in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, which started in 1996 and has resulted in millions of casualties, has not elicited the kind of sympathy now seen in the reporting on Ukraine. But the global South is pushing back, despite the U.S. using every possible forum to browbeat the global South to support sanctions against Russia and weapons to Ukraine. Most of the world has stayed out of the conflict, dismissing U.S. hectoring about the rules-based international orders as hypocrisy. President Macron of France, facing his own pushback for his neoliberal policies, has admitted that the West has lost credibility in the global South. Instead, elected leaders like Lula in Brazil and AMLO in Mexico refuse to support war and urge the world to spend resources on limiting climate change and easing poverty. Meanwhile, China's influence has spread and has actually emerged as a peacemaker in the Middle East and has sought to bring Ukraine and Russia to the negotiating table. As the National Priorities Project reports, last month, Congress passed a military budget, almost $1 trillion, higher than during the height of military spending during President Reagan's Cold War and even the Vietnam War. The Iraq War supercharged the militarized spending that was already surging after 9/11, which has since totaled over $21 trillion. The National Priorities Project calculates that just a fraction of that sum could have totally decarbonized the U.S. power grid, created millions of good jobs, wiped out student debt, housed the houseless, and all but ended child poverty in this country with plenty left over. So far, the U.S. has spent close to $100 billion in military aid to Ukraine, more than the entire Russian military budget. CBS reports that only about 30% of these weapons ends up in the hands of Ukrainians. Yet we continue to support billions in profits for the likes of Raytheon and Lockheed Martin, as expansion of NATO and rebuilding a devastated Ukraine offer more lucrative contracts without any oversight. William Hartung at the Quincy Institute reports that by exaggerating threats of Russia and China, the Pentagon and weapons manufacturers are poised to go on a $10 trillion spending spree over this decade. Although today Americans express their greatest concern around inflation, the corporate media ignores the connection between war spending and reduced living standards that people are facing. We have never heard Biden, Blinken, and Congress answer the question, what is the end game for continued war spending in Ukraine? Countless military officials and observers have said that there can be no military solution. Is it realistic to think that Ukraine can win this war by taking back every inch of territory? No. What does it mean to eliminate Putin? Then what? The U.S. appears resolved to sacrifice Ukrainians on the altar of weakening Russia, but it ignores history and the unintended consequences that come with military interventions and efforts to compel regime change. Every U.S. intervention in the last 80 years has led to disaster, massive death, destruction, displacement, and the rise of new authoritarian or terrorist groups. In the moment of two anniversaries of fruitless wars, last week was also the 50-year commemoration of when the last American troops left South Vietnam. As Katrina Vandenheuvel observes, the U.S. national security establishment still clings to the imperial delusion that we have the resources, wisdom, and charter to police the world, to counter Russia and China in their own neighborhoods, while chasing terrorists in 85 countries, dropping bombs from drones in 7 countries, and dispatching forces to over 100 countries across the world. Surely one of the enduring horrors of Iraq is that despite the calamity, our foreign policy establishment remains unshaken and its worldview remains unchanged. All of the movements in which we struggle, racial, climate, anti-poverty, and labor justice, are ineffective unless we link them to lobby for peace and slash the U.S. military budget. KABU has provided alternatives to the corporate media's propaganda, especially by broadcasting Democracy Now! And there are plenty of other resources from Code Pink, the Quincy Institute, and the Costs of War Project. We must pressure the Biden administration and Congress to push for negotiations, which they have thwarted, even when a dozen countries from Brazil to Turkey have offered to serve as intermediaries. The White House refusal to engage with Putin is leading us into an endless crisis that could lead to nuclear war or, at best, other consequences that are disastrous for the world. Portland's Peace and Justice Works continue its weekly rally for peace and justice every Friday at 5 o'clock in Pioneer Courthouse Square, as it has for 2 decades since before the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Join them and become active in pressuring Congress to back off from warmongering and slash the military budget to build a better future. This is Laurie Mercier for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
That was Laurie Mercier reflecting on the habit of the U.S. to condemn the imperial adventures of other countries like Russia while pursuing its own. We would all like to think that the COVID pandemic is over. We're all sick and tired of wearing masks and limiting our social engagements. But as Fran Michel points out, the pandemic is not over, and all of us, not just the most medically vulnerable, remain in peril from this shape-shifting virus. Pretending that the pandemic is done with only increases our peril, and it is incumbent upon the left community to set an example for how to conduct ourselves in the pandemicine.
I really, really want left organizations to rethink back to normal in the pandemicine. I can't tell you how demoralizing it is to see announcements of meetings or other events that I might want to go to, but for which I see no information about COVID precautions. Is it virtual? Is it hybrid? Will people be wearing respirators? What's the ventilation like in that indoor venue? Are we living on separate planets? Nate Holdren, writing in Pest magazine, has described this feeling as broken sociality. Experiences of community are offered, but not actually present, in that they're present only via serious risks, which are often un- or under-acknowledged. Holdren calls this social loneliness, because it means reduced time doing things and seeing people compared to pre-pandemic, because fewer places are doing anything, let alone enough, to mitigate COVID exposure. And it can also mean feeling alone in a crowd because one is the only person wearing a respirator. This social loneliness, Holdren notes, blurs into another facet of broken sociality, political loneliness. This is the sense of a gulf in values or in understanding of some very important aspects of the world. Knowing that the supposed return to normal means even more dying and life-altering suffering is terrible. Knowing that many people seem not to realize this, that people in officially respected positions seem to find this acceptable, that fellow travelers on the left don't treat this as a priority, that all feels isolating to a degree I find hard to overstate. As Holdren notes, this affective experience is of course less awful than the suffering, inequality, disablement, and death that the pseudo-return to normal is creating. But it's not unrelated, and it all bodes ill for our collective future. We know that our collective crises have disproportionate impacts on those already vulnerable. We know that the pandemic disproportionately harms workers and poor people and people of color and incarcerated people and, of course, the swelling ranks of people with disabilities. And we know that all of this will be getting worse with the end of the federal emergency declaration, with millions being thrown off Medicaid, with the lifting of masking requirements, even in healthcare settings. As Holdren notes, it would be wrong to hold any of this against the folks just trying to make it through. The problem comes from the ruling class, capitalists, government, and mainstream media, who've been trying to enforce back to normal for years now. But I wish that more of my comrades were more skeptical about the mainstream capitalist propaganda, more concerned with care for the vulnerable, and more aware that any of us may be one infection away from becoming vulnerable ourselves. Despite the sociological construction of the end of the emergency, the pandemic has not really ended. COVID is still killing hundreds of people each day in the U.S., and debilitating and disabling even more, even population subgroups commonly considered low risk, since, as the John Snow Project notes, it has in fact not been established that such subgroups exist. Everyone and anyone is at risk. And the risk has not declined in the past year. Nationwide wastewater levels, one of the only reliable measures of viral circulation still available, now that tests are less available, less accurate, and less reported, are higher than they were at this time last year or the year before, and in Multnomah County are almost twice the nationwide level. Although vaccines have massively reduced the death toll during the initial acute phase of illness, their efficacy wanes in a few months, and most of those now dying of COVID are vaccinated. Even at their best, vaccines do relatively little to reduce transmission, long COVID, or other health impacts. Those lucky enough to feel only mild or no symptoms at all can still pass it on to others for whom it may be life-altering or life-ending. Somewhere between 1 in 20 and 1 in 2 people infected suffer the weeks, months, or years-long persistence of long COVID. But there are also less obvious dangers for those who seem to recover. Even among the asymptomatic, each infection further increases the risk of heart attack, stroke, brain damage, new-onset diabetes, kidney and liver damage, hearing and vision loss, and other bodily injury. The virus seems to increase the risk and progression of cancer. It impairs the immune system, making people more vulnerable to other illnesses. Moreover, each transmission increases the chances for the virus to mutate again and potentially to become more harmful. SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19, has evolved so much that a recent article in The Lancet suggested it might actually now be SARS-CoV-3. In the U.S., it has already become more immune evasive and undermined previously useful treatments like Evusheld and monoclonal antibodies. And there's no indication the virus is getting milder, despite a common myth about how viruses tend to evolve. But we have lots of reminders and resources for thinking this through, especially from disability justice groups. As disability activist Mia Mingus has pointed out, there's no reason the slogan, "We keep us safe," should apply only to some forms of harm, like from police or domestic sexual violence, but not to others, like monkeypox or COVID. Or as one longtime HIV/AIDS activist noted, "If you can give out condoms, you can give out masks at the door with a flyer explaining why they're vital for survival and solidarity." So here are some further tips on practicing inclusion in the time of COVID from the group Strategies for High Impact in collaboration with the group What Would an HIV Doula Do? When your group organizes a meeting or other event, think about how to make it genuinely inclusive. Think about how welcoming it might be, or not, to those who can't afford to take time off from work if they get sick, or to those who are immune suppressed or immune compromised or already suffering long COVID or otherwise debilitated or disabled, or who have family members who are. And if you really want to welcome those folks, then ask yourself and your fellow organizers, can we hold our gathering online? If not, how about providing, wearing, and requiring KN95 masks or N95 respirators? Because yes, despite what you may have heard, respirators do work, especially if everyone wears them. How about having a hybrid meeting option? How about meeting outdoors or creating more airflow indoors? Open more windows, build DIY air filters. When you announce your meeting or event, let people know what kinds of precautions are in place. Show that you've thought about it and plan ahead to follow through. What are you willing to do as a group to protect people from COVID exposure? How can you ensure that agreed-upon practices will be followed? Let's do what we can to mitigate the harms of a failed or failing system of public health, to build solidarity, and to keep ourselves, our allies, our accomplices, and our movements as strong and sharp as possible for the struggle ahead. For the Old Mole Variety Hour, this has been Fran Michelle.
You may get the drops or maybe doubled up in pain. your sickness to your family and friends, and it goes around and around, and it may never end.
That was Fran Michel talking about a rational and just approach to the ongoing spread of COVID. Her commentary was bookended by clips from a song called Sickness by the Donner Party. You are listening to KBOO Portland. The evidence is clear that we possess the technology and the means to reverse global warming and spare humanity from its worst effects. But powerful interests are determined to wring every last dime out of the fossil fuel industry and hang the consequences. In this first part of a two-part interview, Bill Resnick speaks with sociologist John Bellamy Foster about how the economic system of capitalism and its need for constant capital accumulation has brought us to the brink of disaster.
Hi, John Foster. Welcome to KBOO.
Hi, Bill. It's really nice to be here.
John Bellamy Foster teaches sociology at the University of Oregon and is also the editor of the Monthly Review, a journal of the revolutionary and democratic left. His research and work is in the political economy of capitalism, and especially how the capitalist system, with its exponential growth imperatives, is now following the natural ecological systems, like of profound importance today, the climate system, the systems upon which human life, indeed nearly all life, depends. These themes, as well as the potential for a truly democratic socialism to save human life, it animates his 10 written books and about 10 edited books and hundreds of articles. His books include The Ecological Rift, Capitalism's War on the Earth, and The Ecological Revolution, Making Peace with the Planet. So today, first, John, what's your sense of the risk? Why does preserving planetary livability for humans require ending capitalism and transforming the economy and ways of living here and around the world?
Let me begin by referring not just to climate change, but the planetary boundaries. In the Science Today and Earth System Science and our understanding of the Anthropocene, there are 9 planetary boundaries that science has designated that humanity is in the process of crossing. And those planetary boundaries basically define the realm of the Earth as a safe home for humanity. If we cross the planetary boundaries, then we threaten our own existence and the existence of maybe most life on Earth. And so the planetary boundaries are important, and climate change is only one of the planetary boundaries that we are crossing or have crossed and that are endangering the existence of human beings on the planet, and not really in the distant future, but with the threats coming upon us in this century, when many of the people listening to this broadcast will be alive. This is the 21st century, and the dangers are coming now. So you have not only climate change, but other planetary boundaries that are being crossed. And the marker for this is basically the Holocene, the geological epoch that we have been in for the last 11,700 years, and that has been very beneficial to humanity and the development of civilization. And we're moving away from those safe conditions to conditions that are extremely dangerous for our species and most other species. And so not only climate change is involved here too, but species extinction. So science says we could eliminate 30 to 50% of all species, all known species in this century. That's actually the trend. It's something like 1,000 times the background rate of species extinction. We've also disrupted the phosphorus and nitrogen cycles, destroying waterways all over the Earth and affecting the ocean. It's not just species extinction, I should say. It's also loss of biological diversity. And then we've broken the nitrogen phosphorus cycles. We are removing ground cover, particularly forests, all over the Earth, and therefore threatening the whole global environment. We're also losing fresh water everywhere. Some of these things overlap with climate change, obviously. So the loss of fresh water is a major concern, and we have a massive chemical pollution globally and creation of new synthetic phenomena, radiation. All of these things are entering into the global or planetary environmental crisis, and climate change is just one of the problems that we're facing. And all of them have to do with the expansion of the economy and the nature of the economy we have under capitalism. Now, if you look up the definition of capitalism in the dictionary, you're likely to find at first a Cold War definition that says capitalism is a system of free markets and free enterprise, as opposed to socialism, which is a planned economy. And it might say capitalism is a competitive system, but that's almost worthless in terms of understanding what capitalism is and why it's a threat to the environment. And the reason we call it capitalism is it's a system of capital accumulation without end. So the driving force of capitalism as a system is the accumulation of capital, which is accumulated by a very small portion of the population. The capitalist class. So it's the extraction of economic surplus from the general population, from the working class, and then the use of this economic surplus for investment or accumulation, which expands the system and actually expands the power and control and wealth of those at the top that own the capital, which is the driving force of capitalism. We say that capitalism is connected to exponential growth. And that's true, but what it all goes down to is the accumulation of capital. So it's a particular form of growth as well. If you have an economy that grows at a 3% a year, our economy doesn't grow that much now, but it's 3% a year is really the basis of a growth rate that makes capitalism work. If you have a growth rate of 3% a year, then the economy increases by 16 times in a century, 250 times in two centuries, and 4,000 times in three centuries. And that's the exponential growth. But we can't even afford at this point to double the size of this system because the pressure of the economy on the environment is so great. And it's not just a matter of scale and the fact that the system constantly demands more and more accumulation. It's also that the more under our present system of a very centralized monopoly capitalism or monopoly finance capitalism, the system expands by all sorts of waste and destruction and the most irrational forms of growth imaginable, which increases the destruction to the environment and to human beings. And of course, all of this sort of rests on the exploitation of the population or the extraction of surplus from the labor of ordinary human beings, working people, and it all ends up in the hands of a few who basically drive this accumulation process. Now, such a system might have been very helpful in terms of rising out of feudal societies and pre-capitalist conditions. It helped in terms of a lot of things. The economic development was insignificant and produced some beneficial results. But in the present time, the system is mostly destructive, that what we call economic growth is mostly destruction, ecological destruction, and so on. And you can see that while the system is still growing, the real wages of, let's say, workers in the United States have fallen back to where they were in the early 1960s. So for the working population, they're not really sharing in this growth. They're not sharing in the results of the accumulation of capital. So we have a system that's exploitive, that's not fulfilling the needs of people, but it's also destroying the global environment. And it is actually not only generating climate change, but it's actually creating all these other problems, the loss of ground cover, the loss of fresh water. These things are not primarily due to population growth. They're due to the economic system, the disruption of the phosphorus and nitrogen cycles. So we have all of that.
This is Bill Resnick talking to John Bellamy Foster on a Rural Variety Hour, broadcast every Monday at 9 a.m. on KBOO. 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. John Foster began this interview discussing planetary boundaries that scientists define as planetary systems that have crossed and endanger human existence. Climate change is, of course, one. Others are species extinctions, radiation, ocean degradation and acidification, fresh water depletion, and there are more. We then discuss why this is occurring. He finds its source, of course, in world economic systems that simultaneously destroy the environment and impoverish humans. So, John Foster, we, humanity, must force profound change. In fact, replace capitalism. How much time do we have?
Now, in terms of climate change, the problem is that we're running out of time because we have to, all the science says we have to get to net zero carbon emissions by 2050. And even if we'd got there, we would have to find a way of getting hundreds of gigatons of carbon, removing it from the atmosphere as well, in order to get to a stable place of 350 parts million of carbon concentration in the atmosphere. So we are running out of time. 2050 isn't that long from now. And the science tells us that we have to reduce carbon emissions by 30 to 40% in the present decade. We have to reduce the emissions by that much globally in the present decade. So this is a planetary emergency. We haven't really succeeded in reducing emissions significantly at all globally. And while emissions have gone down in some areas, like the United States has reduced its emissions the way they're calculated, this is mainly because of switches from coal to oil and natural gas, which also have to be eliminated, but are not as polluting. And because a lot of our production has been shifted to the global south, so the emissions are appearing there and we're consuming products that are based, you know, that are made for us, that are based on emissions elsewhere, organized by our multinational corporations, but occurring in the global south. And the overall situation is that the emissions keep on going up and we don't really have decades left so much, it's years. And the problem is that there are tipping points, and science now thinks that the tipping point is 1.5 degrees increase in global average temperature is a tipping point that could lead, well, will lead it towards disaster. We're already facing extreme weather. We're all already facing a major, major environmental disasters coming in the next decade. But if we hit 1.5 degrees Celsius increase in global average temperature, it will be much worse. So that's what they want to avoid. But all the models presently have us passing that. And only even in the most optimistic model, we pass 1.5 degrees increase in global average temperature by 2040 and only get slightly below it again at the end of the 21st century. And that's the most optimistic model. So we're actually going to pass the target that science has set. And there's another target of staying below, well below 2 degrees Celsius increase, because the science has stipulated, and this is more and more certain, that if we hit 2 degrees Celsius increase in global average temperature, then that will set off so many positive feedbacks in other areas, like you mentioned, the melting of the permafrost and the release of methane, the melting of Arctic ice that will decrease the reflectivity of the Earth and then increase the rate of climate change. Both of these things would accelerate climate change. And of course, the melting of the Greenland and Antarctic ice sheets and the glaciers will result in much more rapid sea level rise. So we're talking about positive feedbacks that would come in effect if we hit 2 degrees Celsius increase. That would basically, the science says, the worry is that this would propel everything out of control. We would no longer be able to reverse it, and we'd be accelerating towards very rapidly in this century towards a 4-degree increase in global average temperature, which the science says would make industrial civilization impossible. And this could be reached in the time of people, you know, a lot of people listening to this broadcast. So we're talking about a few decades we could be facing this planetary catastrophes threatening hundreds and millions and even billions of people. And this is actually, it's already beginning. It's just that we still have time to avoid the tipping points. But the science is now very clear that we have to transform our whole productive system globally in order to avoid it. And the powers that be, those who control the system, are not interested in doing that. And their media system basically serves them. And that's the media system that people are affected by. So people are not really hearing what the science is saying about this necessity of society to transform our production system simply for human survival, as well as issues of equality and so on.
You just heard me, Bill Resnick, talking to John Bellamy Foster on KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. John Foster teaches sociology at the University of Oregon, lead editor of the monthly journal, Monthly Review, written 10 books and edited 10 others. The books include Ecological Rift, Capitalism's War on the Earth, and The Ecological Revolution, Making Peace with the Planet. Also, he's written hundreds of articles. Most of his work addresses the relationship between capitalism and climate change. It concludes that if we, humanity, don't replace capitalism with the world and national economies that provide for all, but without capitalism's exponential growth, a very different productive system, we could be well on the way to the planet's sixth great extinction, including us. In this part one of the two-piece interview, we discuss planetary boundaries. If we cross any of them, we risk extinction. And we're moving towards crossing several as we keep pouring greenhouse gas emissions into Earth's atmosphere, for one. In part two next week, we discuss scenarios in which people in the powerful countries and around the world wake up to demand a total mobilization of all our Earth's resources to stop today's capitalism's death march and discuss what must be done, that we have all the necessary resources, all the necessary technologies to achieve success. Another better, sustainable, and democratic world? It's necessary and possible. So thanks a lot for talking to us today, John Bellamy Foster. Let's talk again.
Thank you. I would be glad to.
Despite repeated warnings of dangers up ahead, captain won't be listening to what's been said. He feels that there's a good chance that we've been misled. And so the captain's planning ahead. What can we do? What can we do? What can we do to stop this foolish plan going through? What can we do?
That was Paul McCartney and his song, Despite Repeated Warnings. Before that, Bill Resnick spoke with John Bellamy Foster about the central role of capital accumulation in producing climate catastrophe. Next up, Desiree Hellegers and Julian Ankeny preview an upcoming social justice conference hosted by Washington State University in Vancouver. The conference, being held April 21st and 22nd, is free and open to the public and available online. It will focus on issues of importance not only to Indigenous nations, but the whole of humanity.
Good morning, Tuts Maywi. This is Desiree Hellegers, and I'm here with Nimipu Mol, Julian Ankeny, who's also the coordinator of Native programs at WSU Vancouver. And we're talking today about the fourth annual SJCon, WSU's Interdisciplinary Social Justice Conference, which is coming up on April 21st and 22nd, and which is on Zoom. Tuts Maywi, Julian.
Tots Lahane, Oiklo, good day everyone. Ina Monique Dwas, Julian Ankney. My name is Julian Ankney. Ina Was Nimi Poo. I am Nez Perce. It is a great day to be in the space here with you talking about SJCon. What a great day to be Indigenous.
So the conference this year is focused on the topic of Native sovereignty, decolonization, divestment, reparations, and environmental justice, constructing coalitions at the intersections. The event is on Zoom. It's free. It's open to the public, but pre-registration is required. So just a quick disclosure that Julian and I are both on the planning committee for the conference. Julian, do you want to talk a little bit about why this conference is so important and actually quite historic?
Yes, Katsiao Yao, thank you. I wanted to share with you some information that we will be highlighting this year. First, treaty-protected fishing rights have played an integral role in the defeat of dozens of proposed Pacific Northwest fossil fuel infrastructure projects. Big oil, coal, natural gas, and methanol companies look to Pacific Northwest ports as a strategic and necessary asset, the most direct exit for fossil fuels headed for West Coast refineries and domestic and international markets. At a 2013 talk at Clark College, Bill McKibben described the Pacific Northwest as having emerged as a great choke point in the struggle for the survival of the planet as we know it. Meanwhile, frontline sea-level Indigenous communities are being forced to move to higher ground at the utmost cost. As of 2023, over 1,500 institutions that control $40 trillion in assets have committed to divesting from fossil fuels, but still more action is needed to mobilize institutions of higher education, faith communities, unions, and local and state governments to divest from fossil fuels and other extractive industries and institutions that target Indigenous communities for exploitation and fuel the crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous people. The moral and political imperatives to reinvest in Indigenous communities hardest hit by extraction, exploitation, colonial violence from law enforcement and man camps, sea level rise, extreme weather, and other manifestations of climate catastrophe merit far more attention and action. How are various institutions implicated in the exploitation of Indigenous lands and people and the exclusion of Indigenous people from equitable health outcomes, education, and investment and access to traditional foods? How do we document, make visible, and address these harms? How do we expand, build, and maintain coalitions to divest from fossil fuels and other extractive industries while reinvesting in Indigenous communities and repair the violence inherent in settler colonialism? What traditional and contemporary models of grassroots activism and coalition building can we draw from?
WSU itself is the product of the 19th century Morrill Act, which created land-grant universities in the United States. WSU is perhaps nationally unique in that it is still holding about 80% of the original land granted to it through the Morrill Act. WSU is in possession of about 73,000 acres still of Indigenous land. So it's really remarkable that we have 15 units at WSU, including entire colleges that have signed on to co-sponsor this event and to really start looking at what is WSU's responsibility. So we're taking up these issues about colonial violence in similar ways to the ways in which Georgetown, Brown, Harvard, and Yale on the East Coast have taken up the conversation about what do we owe? You know, what reparations are possible for universities that have benefited from colonial violence and from the labor of enslaved people?
Yes, thank you, Desiree. Katsiao Yao. WSU SJCon is an interdisciplinary social justice conference launched in 2019 by WSU graduate students in coalition with BIPOC-led community groups. We have accepted proposals for presentations, panels, film, creative work, and workshops that focus on pragmatic and action-based approaches to build and sustain coalitions. Desiree, can you speak to what some of the panels are and who are some of the speakers this year?
Okay, yeah. So we have panels on the salmon scam, criminalization and exoneration of treaty fisher people, on the role of indigenous traditional ecological and cultural knowledge in decolonizing academia. There's a panel on missing and murdered indigenous people, fossil fuels, man camps, and a case for divestment, reinvestment, and reparations. We have a screening and discussion of Jan Hawkins' film, Atomic Bamboozle, The False Promise of a Nuclear Renaissance. Jan will be on that panel along with Kathy Sampson Cruz, who is a member of the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation. There is a panel on indigenous rights and food sovereignty as environmental justice, another on health disparities and mortality in Indian country, and also a panel on Black Indigenous solidarity from AIM and the Black Panthers to Standing Rock and the George Floyd uprising. And that panel features Kent Ford, who's the co-founder of the Portland Black Panthers, Donica Brown and Sky Wilson. Other speakers include the Mole's own Robin White, Robert Collin, lecturer at the College of Law at Willamette University, Tom Keefe, who is a defense attorney in the historic salmon scam case, Lana Jacks, a Lila YM activist, Wilbur Slokish, hereditary chief of the Klickitat, David So Happy Jr., Judy Bluehurst Skelton, professor at Portland State University in the Indigenous Nations Studies Program. That's just a little taste of who will be speaking at this event. The conference, which begins on Friday the 21st at 8:30, is preceded on Thursday by an event also on the Vancouver Climate Action Framework. And that event is from 10:30 to 11:50 on April 20th. And the speakers for that include Don Steinke, Rebecca Small, Kim Harless, and also Sue Marshall. We have a powerful lineup of events happening across these 3 days from the 20th to the 22nd. And again, the conference, it's on the 21st and the 22nd, is coming to you through Zoom. It's free, it's open to the public, but it requires pre-registration. We will post in the website and the link when we post the show. But if you have other questions, you can email me at desiree.helligers@wsu.edu. Thanks so much for joining me today, Julian, and we will see you all soon. This has been Julian Ankeny and Desiree Helligers for the Omo Variety Hour.
You just heard Desiree Helligers and Julian Ankeny speaking about the upcoming Social Justice Conference at Washington State University. Again, a link for pre-registration will be posted on the webpage for this show at kboo.fm. Decades ago, Daniel Ellsberg did the American people a great service at his own peril by blowing the whistle on government lies and misdeeds in its conduct of the Vietnam War. Now, in his final months of life, he sends us words of inspiration, a message that should hearten us as we struggle to create a just and peaceful world. Here's Norm Diamond reading a little bit from Daniel Ellsberg's message.
Daniel Ellsberg turned 92 this past week. You may remember him, you should remember him, as the military analyst working for the RAND Corporation and the U.S. government, who copied and released the Pentagon Papers, showing U.S. government interests and motivations in the war against Vietnam, completely at odds with what the public was being told. Through him, we had proof of government lies. Ellsberg has pancreatic cancer and not much longer to live. Freed from a likely jail sentence by government misconduct, he spent the last 50-plus years as a peace activist, especially against nuclear war. Learning of his medical diagnosis, he sent a beautiful letter to his friends and comrades. I'd like to read you some of it. This from Ellsberg. I feel lucky and grateful that I've had a wonderful life, far beyond the proverbial 70 years and 10. I feel the very same way about having a few months more to enjoy life with my wife and family, and in which to continue to pursue the urgent goal of working with others to avert nuclear war in Ukraine or Taiwan or anywhere else. When I copied the Pentagon Papers in 1969, I had every reason to think I would be spending the rest of my life behind bars. It was a fate I would gladly have accepted if it meant hastening the end of the Vietnam War, unlikely as that seemed, and was. Yet in the end, that action, in ways I could not have foreseen due to Nixon's illegal responses, did have an impact on shortening the war. In addition, thanks to Nixon's crimes, I was spared the imprisonment I expected, and I was able to spend the last 50 years with Patricia and my family, and with you, my friends. What's more, I was able to devote those years to doing everything I could think of to alert the world to the perils of nuclear war and wrongful interventions. Lobbying, lecturing, writing, and joining with others in acts of protest and nonviolent resistance. I wish I could report greater success for our efforts. As I write, modernization of nuclear weapons is ongoing in all 9 states that possess them, the U.S. most of all. Russia is making monstrous threats to initiate nuclear war to maintain its control over Crimea and the Donbas, like the dozens of equally illegitimate first-use threats that the U.S. government has made in the past to maintain its military presence in South Korea, Taiwan, South Vietnam, and, with the complicity of every member state then in NATO, in West Berlin. The current risk of nuclear war over Ukraine is as great as the world has ever seen. China and India are alone in declaring no first use policies. Leadership in the U.S., Russia, and other nuclear weapon states, NATO, and other U.S. allies have yet to recognize that such threats of initiating nuclear war, let alone the plans, deployments, and exercises meant to make them credible and more ready to be carried out, are and always have been immoral and insane under any circumstances, for any reasons, by anyone or anywhere. It is long past time, but not too late, for the world's public at last to challenge and resist the willed moral blindness of their past and current leaders. I will continue, as long as I'm able, to help these efforts. There's tons more to say about Ukraine and nuclear policy, of course, and you'll be hearing from me as long as I'm here. As I look back on the last 60 years of my life, I think there's no greater cause to which I could have dedicated my efforts. For the last 40 years, we have known that nuclear war between the U.S. and Russia would mean nuclear winter. More than 100 million tons of smoke and soot from firestorms in cities set ablaze by either side, striking either first or second, would be lofted into the stratosphere, where it would not rain out and would envelop the globe within days. That pall would block up to 70% of sunlight for years, destroying all harvests worldwide and causing death by starvation for most of the humans and other vertebrates on Earth. So far as I can find out, this scientific near consensus has had virtually no effect on the Pentagon's nuclear war plans, or U.S., NATO, or Russian nuclear threats. In a like case of disastrous, willful denial by many officials, corporations, and other Americans, scientists have known for over 3 decades that the catastrophic climate change now underway, mainly, but not only from burning fossil fuels, is fully comparable to U.S. Russian nuclear war as another existential risk. I'm happy to know that millions of people, including all those friends and comrades to whom I address this message, have the wisdom, the dedication, and the moral courage to carry on with these causes and to work unceasingly for the survival of our planet and its creatures. I'm enormously grateful to have had the privilege of knowing and working with such people, past and present. That's among the most treasured aspects of my very privileged and very lucky life. I want to thank you all for the love and support you've given me in so many ways. Your dedication, courage, and determination to act have inspired and sustained my own efforts. That, from Daniel Ellsberg, from the Marine Corps to lifelong peace activist, this has been Norm Diamond for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
That was Norm Diamond reading from what will likely be Daniel Ellsberg's final message to his friends, family, and comrades. His towering presence in the worlds of social justice activism will be sorely missed. That's a wrap for our show today. I want to thank Moles, Lori Mercier, Fran Michelle, Bill Resnick, Desiree Helligers, Julian Ankney, and Norm Diamond for their contributions, and John Nelson for his editing assistance. And a shout out to the hardworking staff of KABU who make it possible for shows like The Old Mole to be heard in our community. This is Patricia Kohlberg, and I've been your host for the hour. Thanks for listening. I'm going to leave you today with that classic song by Woody Guthrie, "All You Fascists Bound to Lose."
Well, I'm going to tell you fascists, you may be surprised. People in this world are getting organized. You're bound to lose, you fascists bound to lose.
Woo! All you fascists bound to lose.
I said,
all you fascists bound to lose.
Died, you're bound to lose, you fascists bound to lose.
Woo!